And I'll just say this is Daniel Gervais. The date today is March 18th, 2013. And let me get my feedback from back there. So could you tell me your full name, please?
Christopher Robert John Donahue.
And what is the date and place of your birth?
I was born in Halifax, February the 8th, 1946.
Could you tell me a little bit about your background, where you grew up, if you moved around a lot, if you stayed in the city?
No, we were very fortunate to, my father was a businessman. He ran Atlantic Print Limited, and he got involved early on in a subdivision called Rockwood, just up from the Armdale Rotary. In fact, there were a number of people who attended St. Mary's later, young men. We'll perhaps get to some of those later. There were some really interesting people in that subdivision. And I went to school originally at St. John the Baptist School in Purcell's Cove Road, mm-hmm. attached to the St. John the Baptist Catholic Church, from grade primary through two. And I met one of my good friends, Murdoch Rediff, who also attended the high school and university with me, and we'll get more on him and some of the other relationships later as well.
Murdoch,
yes.
Okay,
yeah.
That's cool.
And we knew each other since grade two, and we are still friends today. We meet on a regular basis, along with John Delaney, who was one of the athletes that we're going to try to recognize this year with the Hall of Fame activities. About grade three or four, I'm not sure exactly, we moved. We were on the county side of Dutch Village Road, which was then Dutch Village Road, and we had to move schools. We moved to St. Agnes School on Mumford Road, and I attended there till through grade eight. And the interesting thing in my first connection with St. Mary's was in grade eight, the local parish priest, I think it was, or it might have been Father O'Neill from St. Lawrence Parish, which was the parish we were in. Each parish was able to recommend, I guess would be the way to put it, young boys to go to St. Mary's High School. So I was one of the ones that, and I was quite young. I had started. I went to a preschool when I was four, so for some reason or another, they let me in a little bit earlier than most. So I was always the youngest one through school up until, this is a neat story too, up until St. Mary's High School. I was at the last part of the classes that attended the high school, and the Jesuits had a policy of not having anybody repeat, so you are, if you failed, you were out. But because I failed grade 10, and it was the second, there was a grade 9 behind me that was going to be the last class, so they allowed me to stay and repeat grade 10. And that's kind of caught up with the age group that I should have been with, but I was always the young one. So
okay,
that was my early education. And if you don't mind, I'll transition a little bit into, because there's a lot of people, we talked prior to the tape about the sports book, and there are a number of people mentioned in this, athletes. There were two families of O'Learys that lived in Rockwood. One of the families had two boys, Ted O'Leary and David O'Leary. Ted O'Leary was an extremely good athlete. And one of my very first recollections on entering the McNally building, which is where the university and the high school coexisted, going down the north stairwell to the gymnasium, affectionately known as the pit, there was a picture of Ted O'Leary in full football gear. He was a halfback. What would be like the Heisman Trophy United States pitcher, the halfback,
okay,
with the football under
the
his arm and the arm forward.
The action shot.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And I took great pride as a young boy. He was quite a bit older than I was, and in fact, in university by the time I attended the high school. He later became a Trappist monk, I would guess at least 30 years, maybe more, he was a Trappist monk, and for whatever reason he left the monastery, and he died of cancer probably 20 years ago now, 15 or 20 years ago. His brother David is still somewhere around. I used to see him at the old Halifax Farmers Market at the brewery. We had a small business there, so I used to be there all the time on Saturdays, and I would see him. He was very tall. He was, six or so, and he was so he would stand out in the crowd. The other family was also had connections, strong connections with St. Mary's. Mm. This was Ed O'Leary's, the father. The other, David and Ted's father's name was Bernie O'Leary. They both owned a McDonald Construction, and they were involved, I believe, in some of the construction of the churches, and I think St. Lawrence Church was part of their project early on. The Ed O'Leary's, and that's where Teddy got his name from, the uncle. Mm-hmm. Anyway, his son was Paul O'Leary, and Paul I think in this book, he's referenced in my story that is in the sports book, because he was involved in the Model Parliament, along with a gentleman whose name was Kevin Carroll, who married Paul's sister, Eileen O'Leary Carroll, who was the first female student, and we talked about this when David did his interview, at St. Mary's, along with Jocelyn Grasby. And she was the original full-time student. Jocelyn was the first part-time female student, so it was, so lots of St. Mary's connections when I grew up.
And early on.
As I moved into the St. Mary's situation, I guess. So, yeah.
And connections to the subdivision.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Well, maybe we can skip ahead a little bit.
Sure.
Just jump ahead in the timeline a little bit, and you can talk a little bit about what it was like, the atmosphere of the university, or the fascination of the student body with the first female students arriving.
Well, it seemed it was talked about, but Eileen was a very strong personality, and she became part of the fabric of the whole thing fairly quickly. Plus, her brother was there, and as I mentioned, her not soon to be, but down the road to be husband, Kevin, was there. So she kind of seamlessly worked into things. Mm-hmm. She got involved in students' council activities and was very active. And it just seemed to. She was also physically. She was quite tall, and had a bit of a presence. So.
Okay.
It didn't seem to. I don't recall any creating any major waves at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, what I've read from the journal, it seems that a lot of the overtone is that this was a sense of what was going to be inevitable,
yes,
sort of a thing.
Yes.
So.
There had been talk about the Mount and St. Mary's. Mm-hmm. The Mount was. There were two female institutions: the Mount St. Vincent, and the Convent of the Sacred Heart.
Okay.
Eileen had gone to the Convent of the Sacred Heart, as did my two sisters. They went to the Convent of the Sacred Heart. So a lot of the Catholic girls went to the convent, and the convent was a preparatory school, but went up and prepared them for, most of them went to St. Evex,
okay,
that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the Mount, that whole discussion about joining forces fell through, so it never happened. So
and it's
more likely to happen now.
Yeah,
in
we're
2013.
Having,
yeah.
Seems every so many years the question comes along.
Exactly.
In the same way with the universities, I guess, as with the provinces as well. They talk about, you know, it comes.
Yes.
Can we make
it
on our own?
Make,
that sort of thinking.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So your first impressions, I guess, with St. Mary's, or your first interactions with them,
Well,
were before you got to the campus, because it was this agreement with the, in terms of being let into the institution or being recommended for the institution.
yes, exactly. And I was small, I was young, and I was scared to death when I first arrived. But the Jesuits had a way with their whole system seemed to make things very comfortable. Having an all-male also, and I was not the athlete that many of the young guys were. We had an awful lot of very talented athletes that during my stay through the high school and of course in through the university. But I was nervous, but it became fairly because of routine. Everything was routine. Everything was even their discipline had a bit of an interesting structure to it. They had two interesting components that I'd like to mention quickly. One was what they called Jug, and one of the priests in particular, Father Vince Murphy, whom we called Bonehead Murphy because he was bald. He had, and he was a real character. He had lost a lung in the war, and he had a voice that went up and down. But he was tough, and he would draw a jug, like a drink, a pitcher, a water pitcher on the board,
On the chalkboard.
a chalkboard.
Yeah.
And if you, anyway, stepped out of line, or if you didn't have your assignments completed, your name would go in the jug, which would mean you would either have to go and spend detention time after school. And for us at St. Mary's High School, it was you would have a bit of a break after classes. I think we got out at 3 or 3:30, and then you'd come back from 4, and you'd have to stay from 4 until 5 every day of the week, possibly. And they had what was totally unique. You might have to come back to the university, and I lived, as I was telling you, out past the Armdale Rotary. I would have to come back in on a Saturday morning for a 2-hour jug. And so if you really had some issues, and I have to tell you, I did have to come a few times. The other interesting disciplinary thing that I found totally different, and I became a teacher and an administrator, so I spent 30 years in the school, in the public school system. And the Jesuits used to have this interesting thing. If you stepped out of line in class, you might be asked to stand outside the door. And our classrooms were on the south wing, on the second floor of the south wing of the McNally building. Now, there were little juts in the wall, pillars that were part of the construction. And most of us, if we were put outside, would try to hide and make ourselves thin so you couldn't be seen, because the cloister was at the south end of the building. And if the vice principal, who at my and during my stay was Father, we called him Father Bull Russell, if he walked by and looked down the hallway and saw you, you were immediately brought down to the office and strapped. There were no questions. It didn't matter. If you were out there, you were guilty and you were punished. If you managed to get through till the bell went for a switch over in teachers, because the teachers move, not the students, then you were okay. You got a fresh life. But if you were caught, you were strapped. So, and yeah, I thought that was interesting. And when I started my school administration career, we still had corporal punishment in the old Halifax County system, so I did strap students, but and then they eventually had some enlightenment and got rid of it. But I didn't, I never resented it. I always figured if I was out there, I was guilty.
Sure.
Yeah.
Different way of thinking about it for
Yeah.
sure. But
Yeah.
okay, so well, that's that seems you know, that it creates a sort of a an ominous presence then in the university,
Well,
but.
it was an ominous presence, and when you look back at it, it sounds far away. Nobody, it didn't bother anybody.
Right.
And we would then go out and play hockey or play football, and a lot of the younger Jesuits would participate. So it was just the way things were done.
Right,
so,
right. Yeah. And there was high academic standards, like you said. If you missed a class, or you know, you didn't, wasn't a matter of being held back. You were chucked out.
No, absolutely not. Yeah. There were standards all around. We had to wear ties. We had to wear jackets, and we could be in trouble if we forgot our tie. You'd be running around trying to borrow a tie from somebody, and so yeah, that was part and parcel of the. We had 13 subjects, so and we took exams in 13 subjects. People would say, oh well, yeah, you had. I would say, well, what are they? I'd say, well, we'd have geometry and algebra. Well, that's math. I said, well, we had two different teachers. Father Murphy taught us algebra, and one of the lay people, Mildred Harrington, who was a longtime fixture here at St. Mary's and taught also at the university, she taught us geometry, and we had separate exams for them. They were full courses. We had Latin. Bull Russell taught us Latin, and he was interesting because he did a lot of things. He was an artist, like a cartoonist, and he was very talented. So if he was trying to teach us adverbs in Latin, he would have little centurions doing things, and it was really quite a fun way to learn. So, but we had Latin authors, we had Latin grammar, and we had exams in both of those. We had French authors, French grammar. We had history, of course. We had physics, chemistry. Chemistry was taught by Rory Chow in my stay, another lay person. We had different people taught us. We had some lay people come in and teach us physics, but we used to tie in some with the university, too. We were benefits of having guests like Father Burke Gaffney.
Okay, I've heard that name.
Well, Father Burke at the whole astronomy department here is based on what he did initially. He was world renowned, and we were, you know, very happy. He would come in as a guest lecturer every once. He was tied in with the university more than the high school, but you know, he did that. We had Father de Grozier taught us French. Father Lesage, who was probably my favorite, taught us English, and he had. As I mentioned, I was small, I was young, I was the youngest one there, and I can remember him calling me aside and saying to me, you know, have you ever heard of an author by the name of J.D. Salinger? And I said, no. He said, you should read a book of his called The Catcher in the Rye. And The Catcher in the Rye is a coming-of-age type of book, which probably had more of an influence on me than anything, and his recommendation for me to read it was something. And then I went on to read everything that Salinger wrote.
Before it was an icon book.
Yeah, but
it
was
pop culture.
You have to
events.
Remember that I'm in the '60s, so
he
was only coming out then.
Right.
It became an iconic book.
Yeah.
Through time, so yeah.
Fascinating. Now it's interesting you bring up the pictures, drawing pictures to help with the Latin and things like that. When you first arrived, was there a set teaching style that you could see? You know, so there's different complaints now. There seems to be two ways of thinking about education. Do you teach text? Do you teach test? Do you teach book and dates? Or do you teach more flexible, individualized? How
yes,
did you
yeah,
find
no,
it?
No, exactly what you mean. No, we would be more, the Jesuit teaching during that time would be far more book, a lot more rote. Amo ama samata, mama samata samata. You know, you'd learn declensions, you'd learn dates and chronological events in history and that type of thing. Very much so. Father Murphy used to say, to square a binomial, square the first, square the last, twice the first by the last, and cave signa. And cave signa is take care of the sign in Latin. So, but I still remember that, you know.
Yeah. Well,
50 years later, I still remember
that. Yeah, soaked up so much knowledge. Yeah. But they had the academic discipline, but was there also an athletic, let's say, expectation? Like, you weren't mandated to play athletics, but you would have been...
No, we weren't mandated as such, but
right.
It was very much expected.
Right.
and virtually everybody. Guy Pache, very brilliant student who was an albino, had vision problems, but he would still play intramural. Everything was basically intramural. Now there were, and we'll talk about teams maybe if we get to the project, my project, mm-hmm. but everybody played intramurals. Everybody played. Frank Baldwin, who was the major domo for a number of things early on, he and Bob Hayes came around the same time, and Frank was involved with the bookstore, whom I later worked for in the bookstore. Okay. The canteen, he ran the canteen before giving it over to a couple of guys, Gus and I forget the other fellow's name.
Okay.
It was a fixture, and Frank did a lot of the intramural organization, and virtually everybody played basketball. Virtually, not everybody played hockey. We used to, because we didn't have a rink, and those of us who enjoyed the hockey would get up from wherever we lived and go to Dalhousie Rink usually on a Wednesday morning at 5 o'clock in the morning. And I can still remember there was a guy there that looked after the rink. His name was Jonesy. And we often find him asleep on the bookshelf after a night of socializing.
Right.
And I can still remember pushing old-fashioned, they looked like 45-gallon drums with water and a squeegee on the bottom to clean and wet the ice.
Oh. Okay.
We'd clean it. We'd had to do all that ourselves before we managed to get in maybe an hour of what amounted to shinny hockey, but it was great fun. Mm-hmm. The football we played when the fields at St. Mary's were at the back end of McNally Building, where the entrance to what was the church, Canadian Martyrs Church, mm-hmm. at the time, and they ran the other direction. They ran east-west. There were two fields that ran east-west. And here's the picture you have of this open here.
Right.
This is the field going this way. They ran. Where's the McNally?
McNally's in front there.
Yeah, well, this McNally must be here.
Yeah.
So the fields ran this way.
Two next to each other.
Yeah.
Wow.
And we were out there all the time.
Yeah.
Playing football. We used to get hand-me-down gear from, and I was about, I don't know, 5'4", 5'5" at the time, and the pants would be down to my ankles. The helmets, nothing fit.
Yeah.
But we had great fun.
Yeah.
We had great fun.
It was a
great time. And we would, and basketball tended because the facility was there, and there was a great influence by the university basketball players who were took an interest in us. The school was small, you know. There were less than 100, maybe 120 at any given year of high schoolers, and there wasn't more than a couple of hundred of university students. So everybody knew everyone, and if there were pickup basketball games going on at different nets in the gym, you know, you could be playing with somebody that played on the varsity basketball team, and you know, you were a grade 10 student in the high school. So
okay, wow, fascinating.
Yeah,
you wouldn't get that dynamic now.
No, you wouldn't. No, you wouldn't get that now. And things are more professional, I guess, for lack of a better word.
Sure. They're,
you know, the whole sports thing is very professional.
Taken very seriously.
Taken very
seriously. So in terms of educational background, when you arrived at the high school, what was your initial impression of what you were about to undertake, I guess, and also the institution, because you've managed to see a change a great deal over a long period of time.
Yeah,
but
major change.
Initially, was it daunting? Was it exciting? Did it seem like a bustling place?
Well, it was, as I mentioned, fearful initially, but that was overcome very quickly. And then the camaraderie was there. As I mentioned, perhaps before the tape went on, I still have friends from that period, and so we bonded, and that was, I guess, part and parcel of the whole thing. We chummed together during the summers. We worked together in summer jobs, a lot of us, and that kind of thing. And when I finished at high school in 1963, the last graduating class,
right,
it was a very seamless transition. You know, we finished at the end of May, which was also a distinction between that and the parochial schools, because they had to go to the end of June.
Right.
So we were able to get jobs a little earlier and have a little extra long vacation. But it was very seamless. We just, when I came back in September, enrolled to take my BA, and always wanted to be a lawyer because of my family. Many of my family became lawyers, and I idolized my cousin Terry, who attended the high school and was very, very popular and very athletic. And he kind of took me under his wing when they used to have a whole hazing thing with Frosh Week, and they would have different things, and they'd make you do push-ups and this, that, and the other. And they'd have a slave sale. So
okay.
Terry bought me at in my freshman year, and was pretty lenient with me, actually. So
yeah.
So it was just, you knew all the people, you know, the people who were sophomores and juniors and seniors in college,
right,
had been ahead of you in high school, so a lot of them. So you knew them. Yeah.
Excuse that's fascinating, because it's not the normal sort of situation where you arrive at an institution. Maybe it's away from home.
Yeah.
Maybe it is close to home, but it's a brand new experience. But so did you ever hesitate about going to St. Mary's, the university? Did you ever think, well, I've seen enough of this place? Or did you think, well, this has just been the best. I don't see why this should end now.
Well, I guess the best way for me to answer that is,
yeah,
in 1963, I left the high school.
Yeah.
I went on to take 4 years to get my BA.
Uh-huh.
I came back to get my BED.
Okay.
And 10 years later, in 78, I took a master's. And then somewhere in the 90s, I got a TESOL certificate, all at St. Mary's. I did take courses at Dow, and some at the Mount, as a part of when I became a teacher.
Right.
But I just sort of was attached to St. Mary's. And no, I never really, my older sister went to St. Evex. My younger sister went to St. Evex, and both went to the convent. But my whole transition was just very, very normal. That was the expectation.
Mm. And obviously, you were having, the kind of experiences, you know, that were going to stay with you, making friends that were going to stay
with
you.
Yes. Yeah. And I'm sure that if you scratch the surface deep enough, the friendship and the camaraderie was certainly a strong part of it. And it's why so many of the students who attended the high school just
went on to
the university. So it was very much a cornerstone of, in fact, before there was a college, there was a high school, and before there was the college moved, that was always a high school all the way through the picture. I wrote a letter to Paul Puma to recognize the athletes from the high school era at next fall's homecoming.
Right.
And my preamble letter talked about that, about the fact that before any of that, that there was always a high school until 63. And so there needs to be some recognition, and some of the research that we've looked at here at the archives at St. Mary's, there's no record of any. It's almost like the high school didn't exist.
Wow. Yeah.
So it's important. I think there is a plaque
Definitely.
From our 1988 reunion on the front of the McNally Building, giving a little bit of history.
Side there. Yeah.
Right on the main entry.
Yeah.
Yeah. On the right hand side.
Right.
That's correct.
Exactly.
Correct. Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah. I've seen that. Yeah. Definitely. But it is surprising, you know, because, like you say, the high school had so much importance and prominence,
yeah.
you know, for so long. So
yeah.
it's great that it's getting the attention it deserves now
yeah.
again.
Well, that is for me. It's important. Yeah.
Well, I think it's important.
There's not as as many of us left now. So.
So yeah. now, you always knew that there would be a special connection at the very least to you and your time at St. Mary's. But you keep coming back, and that's great. At the end of your first year finishing your BA,
yeah.
were you able to sense that there had been some significant changes from when you first arrived at the high school? I mean, aside from the fact that the high school is no longer there now, or it's not going to be there. But were you looking around and saying, the times they are changing, or what was the feeling?
Yeah, I had matured. I was, you know, you'd mentioned about going away to university and a lot of people having freshman issues. Well,
yeah.
It was no different even though I was transitioning. I struggled in my freshman year, was not very successful academically, was not entirely successful in my second year. But by the third year and fourth year, I picked up my socks. I spent summer in summer school to try
okay.
and in the first 2 years because I had to make up for lost time and lost initiatives, I guess. So it wasn't without some bumps along the road, but I had good support structures here, and Kevin Cleary was a very very good influence on me and a support. I had my aunt on my mother's side, Florence Foley, was the assistant librarian at the Patrick Power Library.
Okay.
Patrick Power is also connected to our family too.
Okay.
So,
okay.
So there, yeah. Although he was long dead, but there was long time
another
connection.
Tie.
Another tie.
Yeah.
All sorts of connects there. Yeah. I did decide at the end of my. Again, influence from my cousin Terry, his brother Arthur, who didn't attended St. Mary's University, but not the high school. He went to St. Pat's High School. Not entirely sure why, but they both went on to be lawyers. And so I, and their father, my Uncle Richard, who was a Attorney General of the province and later a senator, Canadian senator, they were all lawyers, so I kind of had that in my mirror.
Right.
Well, eventually my mirror. I actually went to Dell Law School with a fellow Santa Marian, Banjo McCormick, who was a very bright English student, and we both went up to see Dean Mackay over the summer between what would it have been, summer of 68, 69.
Mm.
And I applied to Dell Law School. I was accepted at Dell Law School. I was also accepted through job interviews that St. Mary's University had put on. I went to an Imperial Oil interview, and I was told them I was interested in advertising.
Mm-hmm.
And they sent the president of, God, whose name was Twaits at the time, to Halifax to interview me. And they offered me a job to go to Toronto. I decided for some reason or another mm-hmm. that I was not going to take that. I was not going to go to, I was going to go back to St. Mary's and take a BED.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
life changes and
yeah.
switches
yeah.
around. So I never did go to law school, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
yeah.
But you came back to St. Mary's and did the BED. Was the BED a new program at this time?
Relatively new, yes.
Mm.
Yeah. At that time, all the universities had BED programs. It was only till 20 years later that they, through the provincial government, that they decided that there was too many students being graduated with BEDs.
Mm.
And I'm not sure now how they decided what schools would have to drop their programs, but St. Mary's was one. Although St. Mary's still had to this day, has education-style courses, and I still have another connect. I do have done contract work for the University of Maine at Presque Isle.
Okay.
For students, some of whom took courses here at St. Mary's and then were... us to check out the Presque Isle campus, and they went down to take their BED.
Right.
And I became a supervisor for their practicum when they came back to Halifax to take their practice teaching.
Okay.
So this, the connections go on. And,
definitely.
Yeah, so...
How did you find, I mean, these are some amazing changing times for the whole world, but of course for the university too at this time, the Radio St. Mary's, the
yes.
Journal, the student incorporation, I think, of the union,
yeah.
Even the arena going up, that was earlier in the 60s, and,
yeah.
and the library, the Burke Building, that sort of yeah. stuff. When you were finishing your BED, did you then look back again and say, wow, I started here, but that's no longer here now, and then I did this, and then I could have went over here, but I stayed here, and now I'm moving forward this way. What was...
Well, I did move on to some extent.
Mm.
I was looking at a career.
Right.
I had met my wife, Pat, my soon-to-be wife, Pat.
Okay.
We were the last couple in July 12th, 1969, to get married in Canadian Martyrs Church at the McNally Building, not the new Canadian Martyrs,
right.
but where it faces, we were talking about the football field.
Yeah, yeah.
And we were the last people to get married before they closed the church down. It became a reading room.
Mm.
And sort of attached to the facility, but and the other interesting thing was in 1988, the people who joined us, the high schoolers who joined us for what we called the reunion in quotation
right.
marks,
right.
From all over the world
yeah.
to recognize the 25th anniversary of the closing of the high school. One of the activities that we put on was a basketball game, because I mentioned the importance of basketball to
right,
all of us
right.
and Frank Baldwin was still alive then. Frank came and we had teams, and here's an interesting, we were going to play a full court game, but we played for about 5 minutes full court
yeah.
and the decision was made we'll play at one basket the university in its generosity kept the pit open for us.
Okay.
Because they were going to tear it all down, and that's where the computer labs, first computer labs went in, was where the gym was. I still have somewhere in my stash of stuff, I have cutouts from the bleachers, hardwood pieces of the bleachers, which I had written on them when they were taken down. But yeah, we played the last basketball game ever played at St. Mary's in the pit. Yeah, in May
cool.
of 1988.
Wow, and had the wedding as well.
And that? we had our wedding. So I had a couple of historical events at St. Mary's.
Yeah.
I was also involved. I was manager of the hockey team, and I was in the manager of the last team before they dropped out of hockey in order to get to build. We used to have to travel to Shearwater by bus.
Right.
And I was equipment manager and everything else, and I had to lug all these sticks and bags of sticks and equipment, and but all sorts of fun stories. We
yeah.
had amazing trips. I can remember Bob Hayes taking he had gear in the trunk of his car, and he somehow couldn't get it open, and he took a bar to and broke the lock to get the gear out. Yeah, there were all sorts of I don't know whether you want to get into those kinds of things, but
well, yeah, I mean it's interesting, it's fascinating, because the academics sort of push you, they give you the drive,
well,
the
it's the camaraderie.
Yeah,
this is where the build up of the camaraderie.
Yeah.
We went on a hockey trip to Moncton, Université de Moncton, and somebody, we used to travel by car a lot of the time, so I often borrowed my father's car, and I'd take three or four guys and gear,
yeah.
and Hayes would take his car, and Les Goodwin, who was then a basketball coach, would take a car, and somebody else. Anyway, we would go on these trips, And on one occasion, I can still remember, I was with someone else, and I think it might have been a hockey player, guy from Dartmouth, Jack Lovett. And I think he found a party, a nightclub place. And somehow a bunch of us ended up at this nightclub place, and Hayes was not happy. He found us, cursed us out, and put us in different cars, and a very talented hockey player, Bill West, and I ended up in the back of Hayes' car, and Hayes and Les Goodwin were in the front. I'm not sure why, but and all the way back, he kept the windows down. This is, we were driving back from Moncton to Halifax, and it was as cold as it is today, about minus eight, and he kept the windows down, and every time in the back, and had the heat in front. But I learned out afterwards why he was so cheesed at us. When they were looking for us, he went the wrong way down a one-way street, and Les realized it, told him to stop. He stopped on a railway cross, and there was a train coming, and the bars that come down, the wooden bars to block, came right on top of his roof, and he had to gun it to get out of there and scraped all the paint off the top of his roof. Needless to say, he was not a happy camper.
That's wild. Yeah, that's a wild story. Well, yeah, okay,
I have a number of them.
Well, and that's sort of it, those experiences, they built up, like you said, the brotherhood and so the friendships.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, it all played a part in helping to shape the future of the university as well.
Oh, I think so. No question. Yeah. We idolized Bobby Leahy, who is in the Hall of Fame. He was an amazing basketball player. Came from Lewiston, Maine. We took a combined hockey basketball trip to what's the name of the Air Force Base in Aroostook, Maine. I can't remember the name of the Air Force Base, but they ended up having put on a great big spread for us. They made the mistake of having alcohol available, and many of us decided to take advantage of the free of the free food and the free booze.
Free libation.
And there was a lot of singing. Hayes used to like to sing that old Black Magic. And we're half, well, I shouldn't say, we're about 20 minutes out of the Air Force Base. I wish I could remember the name of it. Anyway, and somehow or another, we realized that the all-star, all-Canadian basketball player Bobby Leahy has an Air Force, I don't know, a colonel's hat on. Well, he had just decided he'd take that with him as a souvenir. And Hayes saw it, got wind of it, turned the bus around, and we went all the way back. And the bus was, from the time we left the second time, was pretty quiet on the way home. But it was those kinds of stories that...
Wow. Air Force Girl. Yeah. Just a souvenir, for the war, one for the road. Yeah, that's great. Yeah,
exactly.
That's fantastic.
Exactly.
Maybe... could talk a little bit about your current project, the alumni project.
Yeah. Well, can I preface it with a little touch on the 1988 reunion?
Yeah, let's talk about
cause
that.
That's where it, because of the sense of camaraderie and the friendships that were made over the years.
Right.
And everyone had this amazing connect with their experience at the high school. So 63 had closed, everybody went their own way, and some of us kept in touch in my class, that kind of thing. But, you know, in 1986, my wife and I were at the historic feast, dinner club thing.
Okay.
And we look across the way, and I see a former high school colleague, Kent Robinson. And Kent and I did this thing that... false running with the slow motion running.
Okay, across. Yeah.
This was
chariots
as fun as
it.
Yeah, chariots of fire
the,
thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Running across the dance floor and embraced each other. Hadn't seen each other for a long time. That was the start of the planning for the recognition of the 25th anniversary of the closing of the high school, which later became known as the reunion. Mm. It took us 2 years in the planning, and it brought together all sorts of people. David Fleming, whom you interviewed last week. David, I contacted David because of his background as a museum curator to put together displays for the event. It took him 2 years, did an amazing job. People that I hadn't seen that had people with their own careers. We had committees for just about everything. It turned out the very efficient Jesuits somehow weren't very efficient at keeping records, or at least knowing where they were, because we couldn't find anything. So we had a committee to locate people, and it was interesting. One of the people that are in the Oral History Project, Edmund Boyd, who's also related on my Uncle Richard's wife was a Boyd, so he's connected there. He was just amazing. He sat in on these meetings, and he would tell you where people were, where their mothers were, and so he was very instrumental in us tracking down so many people. We sent out letters. I had asked Pat Curran, Judge Curran, to co-chair it with me, and Kent was the secretary treasurer. But we had all sorts of people on committees that, all high school people. And I told somebody after the reunion that my reunion was the 2 years prior to it, because I was so busy during the four-day weekend that I really didn't get a chance to socialize, other than I participated in the basketball game, and we had a full mass with the Archbishop and all that kind of stuff. But it was an unbelievable event. And there's so many of them. Charlie McGuire, who was also related, we asked him to be the head table monitor at the event, at the dinner, at the formal dinner we had. And a fellow by the name of Vance McDonald, after we had gotten rid of Burpee Hallett, very famous professor here, George Burpee Hallett, was the guest speaker, and he talked about teaching all of us and how much we were all reprobates, and using his unbelievable vocabulary to have fun. Ance McDonald came up and chastised me. I was at the head table, and he chastised me for not having done much about the borders. Now, the borders, there were day students and boarders. Well, when I was there at the tail end of the high school, there were no boarders. They had all been, by that time, moved into the high school. Into the university.
Okay.
And so, but he sang what they called the boarders song, and actually it was kind of nice, because his chastisement was tongue-in-cheek. He ended up giving me a certificate, making me an honorary member of the Border Society, which was kind of neat. So, but it's that kind of thing that was just, and it was a major event. So, almost 25 years later, I'm thinking I ran into Pat Curran at the Midtown Tavern, which was another. So it's another sort of an interesting connection. And we talked about, I said, I've got an idea. And I said, there's no recognition of any of the high school athletes who were instrumental in being such a major part of the high school. And I said, there were basketball teams in particular in the late 58 through... What's the date? I broke them down here somewhere. I don't have them on this, but anyway, 58 through 62, I think, is what it was. And there was there were only 100 students in the school, but they had two basketball teams playing extracurricular basketball in city competition and eventually provincial competition. So for 3 years, the B team won city championships, and they won the first three, and then in the second year, the A team won three consecutive years, and then in the last of those 2 years, the A team won provincials. So they defeated every school in the province and won provincial banners in basketball. So I thought this would be a nice way to sort of epitomize all of the athletes and all of the sports by selecting these people. So I'm in the process now of another connect with St. Mary's University to through Paul Puma as chairman of the University Hall of Fame.
Okay.
And through the support of people like David Fleming, Kent Robinson, who unfortunately suffered a stroke about a month ago, and trying to arrange to go down and see him. He did a lot of the groundwork. And Mike Doherty has taken over doing some of the research to make sure we have all the correct names. And we've had a nice connection here with Hansel at the archives and Mary Ann Day through Alumni Engagement Services. And so we're working on that now and hope to have a plaque dedication presentation in this fall, in October, during the homecoming to recognize the 50th year of the closure.
Wow.
And a lot of the people, unfortunately, that were around in 88 and that were on these committees and took place are no longer there. But
it's so important, you know, when you talk about athletics as well, when you look at the legacy of the school, the institution of sport, of athletics, of having that sort of, I guess, American-style sports school, you know. A lot of, I mean, it's interesting. It draws some controversy, but I think it's much admired around St. Mary's, this idea that we have our teams, we have our team spirit, and things like that.
Yeah.
For the project, jumping back to 88, for the reunion, as it became, you know, the reunion.
Yes.
Was that before or after your MA? Did you do that?
That would have been before. My MA was in... Oh, no, it would have been after. My MA was 78, so 10 years. Sort of do things in 10-year groups.
Yeah. Okay,
BA
yeah.
in 68, 78, MA, then 88.
And you had your events, for the most part, at St. Mary's.
They were all, well, other than we had some hotel activities.
But okay.
No, we had...
the basketball game in the pit.
We had the basketball game in the pit. We had, we used the area where the Canadian Martyrs Church was.
Right.
We used that for our opening evening where David set up all of his displays.
Okay, yeah.
And we had pictures and banners and all sorts of things.
Wow.
And we do have a videotape. One of the few things that is that we've been able to locate, I had a copy of it, is the reason. And Mary Ann Day at Alumni Services is getting it
transferred
over to a DVD, and we're going to try to edit that, so we'll at least have that. I've located a couple of pictures, basketball pictures.
Okay.
I contacted Mike Doherty. He called me on the phone, and he said, I have some pictures. I said, well, I'll be having those. Because all of the materials that David had put together had been misplaced. There was no archives here, and David had everything itemized, and it was left with... alumni people at the time, and we're hoping, Mary Ann thinks that there may be some chance that it's still in their offices somewhere, so she's got a search on, which would be lovely to have, and to have here in the archives.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
Really.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Well, it is the essence of the school for that time. So a lot of cooperation then for 1998, or 1988 rather, for the reunion. With the new project, honoring the athletes, having another recognition, you know, a sort of good recognition of the school. What is the university doing with you? You're working with alumni, obviously.
Well, I started with Paul and I are university colleagues, so we spent time together at university.
Right.
So I've known Paul since the 60s.
Okay.
And would see Paul at all the football events. And I went to the Hall of Fame recognition last fall because Bill Scollard was one of the people being recognized. Putty Reardon was another one.
Okay.
And isn't it awful? Who's the third one? Very talented football player, linebacker, whose name eludes me at the moment. But I knew all three of them in one connection or another.
Okay.
Bill Scollard is married to Deanie Del Valette. Now, Del Valette, her brothers Tommy, who was in my class, I have a picture of him.
Tommy Dovalette.
He died young.
Okay.
And his two older brothers, Louie and Bobby. Louie and Bobby both played on this A basketball team that I'm talking about. Louie died of Lou Gehrig's disease 10 years ago. I may be off there. Mm. But it, in some ways, was instrumental in what we're doing, because Kent Robinson, who was also on that team, decided when Lou had Lou Gehrig's that he would research the basketball thing as a bit of a connect with Louie and to talk about. And so he did a lot of research. He did the initial research.
Right.
And then, unfortunately, as I say, had a stroke.
Right.
He is improving. I'm planning to go down and see him next week.
Okay.
But so it's just the connections simply go on and around,
it's amazing.
Yeah. So yeah. Bill and I got to know each other fairly well. We had a business in Keith's Brewery.
Okay.
Called Housewarmings, a gift store, which we closed last April. But I'd see Bill all the time because he's an executive with Labatt's. So it was great to see him recognized for his talents as an athlete, and a fine athlete he was. Stepped in the Vanier Cup and became the quarterback when Billy Robinson was unable to play.
Mm.
And quarterback almost to a win. We didn't win, but he had an amazing, amazing game, an amazing career.
Mm. So, and a lot of, it's interesting, so much has been touched on in the Huskies in Pursuit of Excellence, the book that they put together. And, of course, right here it says that you submitted four stories for the book. The one that went in
is Father Hennessy, the revered Father Hennessy, who became an icon here at St. Mary's,
right.
And all sorts of connections with almost all the athletes. He was the hen, affectionately known as the hen, but almost because he was like a mother hen.
Right.
He would always be there and be around and whatever. He decided, the story is basically about a number of us, some of whom I've mentioned, Paul O'Leary, Kevin Carroll,
right.
A fellow by the name of James O'Hagan, who was on my 88 committee.
Okay.
Were involved in politics. As I mentioned, I had an interest in becoming a lawyer through university.
Right.
My major was political science with Dr. Bill Dalton.
Okay.
And so there was a model parliament going on. Father Hennessy decided that he would show us that there was another side to the political spectrum, that a revolution could take place. So the sports connection is, he involved the football players, Paul Puma amongst them, and a number of other people, to put on bands, headbands, and face paint, and this, that, and the other thing, create a revolution. They came down, and it got quite wild. I want to read, not read, but Pat Curran put an addendum to mine, says, he said, I remember the day of the particular parliament well, because as the retiring student council president, I played the part of the Governor General, read the speech from the throne. Then I stayed around to watch the excitement, mostly sympathizing with the rebels. What Chris didn't include was that all the university political parties had been upset that few students had bothered to vote in the mock election. So in order to teach the non-voters a lesson, the parties decided to conspire and form a dictatorship or oligarchy in which no one but the chosen few would have any rights. They passed a, quote, law by which ordinary people would be known as tools, subject to the control of all powerful police known as power tools. The power tools consisted of football players in a uniform which included a beret, and their chief was Tom Haney, who was, I assume, auditioning for his future role with the military police. One can only imagine how Father Hennessy, a Bostonian from Bunker Hill, reacted to any government trampling on individual rights. It was no surprise that he encouraged the revolution. It was part of his heritage. The resulting battle, which mostly injured pride, was really more of a civil war than a revolution, as there were football players and other friends on both sides. Like Chris, I also learned something that day I've never forgotten, but something different. I learned that if you light a fire under people, you might just end up getting burned. So it was
That's
quite
amazing.
An event. The
That's
tables
amazing.
Were turned over, and there were no real punches thrown that I recall, but
but
a lot of profanities.
Yeah,
and,
yeah. Well, meanwhile, you've got your student government getting ready to stage a
yes,
dictatorship or
yeah,
take
yeah.
over, and then you've got the rebels coming in for a coup, all thanks to Hennessy.
Yes,
the
that's right.
That's amazing.
That's right.
That's amazing. It's clearly the experiences were more than once in a lifetime. You know, it was a certain time and certain people, and everything sort of fell into place in the perfect way. And it's fantastic that now, moving forward, there's not only the record of it, but the recognition, I guess.
Yeah.
Is there anything you wanted to add? You mentioned talking about subdivisions, your friend Murdoch, and...
Well, we still have... My wife and I, because we had our business downtown, got into the habit of attending regularly on Saturdays, to have a bite to eat on the way home, because we would close our business with the market at 1 o'clock. So
okay.
we would go to the Midtown.
Okay.
And that was sort of a tradition too, like going to Diana Sweets on Roby Street after the hockey practices. And we would go on Saturdays to the Piccadilly or the Midtown, or sometimes both. And it became, as adults, we started going there. And when Murdoch moved back from Ottawa, and John Delaney and his wife, Vicky, when they moved back from St. John, we kind of got together, and we now call ourselves the Midtown Board of Directors.
Okay.
And we meet there quite regularly on Saturdays and conduct business. We talk about, John was on the A-team, very good basketball player, very good athlete. And John, he's mentioned in the book, actually, as a football player, not as so many people played multiple sports.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Bobby Leahy played. He was a star basketball player, but he was a receiver. He was a marvelous football player.
Mm-hmm.
Dick Loisel, who I wrote a story about as the St. Mary's the best natural athlete St. Mary's ever had.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't published. He was.
Was that for the Journal?
No, this was for the book.
Oh, okay.
I wrote a story about another. I called it the snowball incident, where Bobby Rotolo, another fine multi-sport athlete who was an all-Canadian football player,
mm-hmm.
and he also played backup goaltender on the hockey team, and so Bobby and I got to know each other there. I'll summarize it very quickly because it's a neat story. And it again shows the camaraderie.
Mm-hmm.
We're traveling to St. Evex for a hockey game. The goaltender of record was Mike Antle, who became a dentist in New Brunswick.
Mm-hmm.
Mike, Bobby, and I, we got there early, mid-afternoon for an evening game. We decided we'd wander around the campus. We went down and we found what was a weight room. And there were two obvious football player types who were bench pressing a fair amount of weight.
Mm-hmm.
And as I also mentioned, we at the university, much like the high school, we had to wear jackets and ties.
Mm.
So we had jackets and ties on. These guys were in workout stuff.
Yeah.
And they were pressing. So we were watching, and there was some kind of snicker or something from somebody. And the guy said, "Oh, so you think you can do any better?" And I said, "Well, I can't, but Bobby can lift way more than that." And they laughed. And so I said, "What do you think, Bob? I'm going to show them?" And he said, "Yeah, I'll give it a try." And he took his jacket off, handed it to Mike, loosened his tie about 2 inches.
Just loosened it.
Just loosened it. That was on purpose.
Yeah.
And now Bob was he was built like the proverbial brick house.
Right.
And he was strong.
Mm-hmm.
He did a couple of things which psychologically were unbelievable. The tie was the first thing. He got down on the bench, and he looked at the weights on either side of the bar, and he said, "If we're going to do this, let's make it worthwhile." He said, "Put another 20 on either side." Now, these guys were lifting. I don't remember to now. This was 40, 50 years ago.
Yeah.
And he they put it on and laughed. Bobby proceeded to take the bar and did 10, mind you. 10 reps. 10 reps. Put the bar back up, got up, did his tie up, took his jacket, slung it over his shoulder, and walked
and away he went.
And away he went. And it was, these guys were, oh,
yeah,
man.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But he wasn't a guy that was always pumping iron. He was just.
Well, he, yeah, he did pump iron.
He did pump iron.
Oh, yeah. He was. He would have done a lot of weight work with the football.
It
didn't have a hockey connection. I don't really recall Bobby playing any games, to tell you the truth, but he was there as the backup.
Right.
But, yeah, a lot of guys that, especially early on, the numbers were small. So the guys played a couple of sports. There were all sorts of them. I had jotted down a couple of them. Some of the others that I had. Al Keith was another one. Al Keith was on the hockey team. Dick Loisel, who I mentioned, I thought was the finest athlete. I'll tell you the tail end of the story that I was mentioning before we put the tape on.
Right.
He came up, Dick Loisel came up from New Hampshire as a football recruit. He was a fine halfback. He was a fine quarterback. He could play either position. He had played school in New Hampshire. He had recognized as a very fine pitcher, and the Milwaukee Braves put him in their AAA. He went in the Golden Gloves boxing championships, and I found out this just before Dick died. He won his first two fights, and then they found out he was underage and wouldn't let him fight anymore. When he came up here, he played basketball, he played football, and the reason I wrote the story and went on at some length, I mentioned the fields going two different directions.
That's right, yeah.
We had there's some track and field in the sports history book, but we did very little track and field at the time. But those who did, there were a couple of guys who were good runners and that kind of thing. But one day I was out looking around the field and I see these two guys throwing a javelin. And they're doing okay, not too badly. And then I see Dick Loisel walk over. And I see Dick showing them how to properly nestle it, how to properly
go,
all the technique things and whatever. And then he heaved the javelin, I'm saying 40, 50 yards beyond what these guys who were going into competition threw it. Well, I found out, and that was my story. And at the board of directors meeting one day at the Midtown Tavern, Dick Loisel and some of his group were at a table, and they'd had their dinner, their meal, and they got up to leave. And Dick was walking out with a cane. And I said to my group at the table, I said, I just finished this story about Dick. I'm going to go out and ask him what's wrong with him and tell him I'm writing this story. And I'm so pleased that I did because... Unfortunately, he died about 3 weeks later. But I went out and said to him, I told him the story that I had included, this reference to him throwing the javelin. He said, Chris, you know what you don't know? He said, I threw javelin in high school. So he was an amazing athlete. Another interesting connection I had when I was in university, in my fourth year university, I had a friend who asked me if I would help coach the wheelchair basketball team. And I coached the wheelchair basketball team for a year. And the guy who took over from me was Dick Loisel, who eventually he made this whole process and became involved in paraplegic sports and what part of his career. So it was all sorts of, again, really quite interesting connections.
Wow, that's amazing.
And we digressed about the, I got to tell you the last story about the snowball incident with Bobby Rotolo.
Right.
We're at a hockey game at the original old Dalhousie Rink, not the one they're tearing down, tore down recently.
Yeah.
But the previous one.
The previous one.
And it was an old building, and it had maybe 20 bleacher seats around the circumference of the rink, other than the entryway door. And then there was a walkway up around the top, which was maybe 5 or 6 feet wide. I forget exactly, but. we always sat at the south corner of the rink, we being the St. Mary's contingent.
Mm.
And we took up a whole segment, and we cheered on. This would be a time when the Soupy Kelly and Granville Kelly and these kinds of hockey players were playing.
Okay.
And we were competitive, and there was a lot of good hockey players at St. Mary's. But Dal was pretty much a good, real force at that time.
Right.
And they were a much bigger, bigger university. Mm-hmm. This particular game, there was between, I don't know if it was between periods or during a break in play, but there
mm-hmm.
was a chant from the Dalhousie side. And everybody kind of stopped. Looked, this whole group stood up, and they fired. We thought it was snowballs from the ice, from the where they would push up the ice. They didn't have Zambonis then. And all of a sudden, this white sea of white, what we thought were snowballs, came flying over. And Bobby Rotolo was seated behind me. I can still remember it, picture to this day, as this snow, what I thought was a snowball, over my shoulder and hit Bobby right on this beautiful St. Mary's football jacket. And there were eggs, fresh eggs, and splats. Leaves were splatting all over us. Well, Bob Rotolo, and I told you the other story, he got up, looked at his jacket, and he walked. He didn't run. He started to walk, and he walked up to the round, across the front of the arena where the doors were, up the stairs to the ramp, and a bunch of the other guys followed him, mostly the football players.
Yeah.
And they walked up, and of course these guys that had thrown them see these coming, and they get up and they started to take off. And then somebody must have said, "Whoa, what are we running for?" And they stopped, and Bobby Rotolo just kept a steady pace along. He walked up and he lowered his fist, and whomp, the first guy went down. And that, and then it was a great brawl.
Yeah.
But that was the snowball incident. But
wow.
there were a lot. There was a real rivalry with Dalhousie.
Yeah.
I remember going up when we stole the tiger. One time they had a stuffed tiger as their
mascot.
Before we had a mascot. We didn't have a mascot.
Right, okay.
I go back to the times when we sang, "Oh, when the Saints go marching in." That was our song. When Freddie Walker and Billy Mullane and these guys were playing basketball for St. Mary's. They were the Santa Marians. So,
right, yeah. Okay, Santa
And we
Marians.
Sat in the pit, the high school kids, we sat in the pit in the balcony behind the basket. And Father Hennessy, as a matter of fact, got extremely upset with us because we thought it was impolite, which you see it all the time now, but we would wave our hands and try and distract the foul shooter.
You
know, we got in trouble for that. So different times.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Again. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, all sorts of. They had ping pong tables under, and the Asian guys would show us how to properly play.
Yeah.
There were some guys, I don't remember their names before, could they ever play.
Back and forth.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, so. Wow. And all this on top of having your studies A1 level,
mm-hmm.
you know.
And you know what I noticed coming in last week to the archives and then today?
Right.
I mean, other than the fact, the obvious thing, all the buildings and all the new construction, is the numbers and the numbers of places that students have to study.
Right.
I wandered around downstairs before I came up here. We're in the library building, of course. And it just amazed me because we used to have to find, there used to be underneath the cloister, Kent Robinson and I used to, in university, used to study. We took history courses together.
Mm.
And you could never find anywhere quiet to study. So we would go, there was a little room, sort of a waiting room for the, if you were going to visit a Jesuit, I think, and we would do all-nighters in there to study for exams, and now I see, you know, there's hundreds and hundreds of places to go, and, you know, and quiet study, or group, all these little group rooms that were all in use today, which was kind of neat.
What do you think if you could take the high school crew, just as they were then, say, just a year before graduation, and plop them down now in the atrium next to the living wall, Yeah, what would they make of it all? Would it seem unnecessary or extravagant, or would it seem
like... Oh, no,
like,
I don't think so. No. No, it very conducive to relaxation, and it creates... I thought there was a marvelous ambiance in here in the building.
They'd probably all run over to the arena.
Yeah.
They'd be...
Yeah. Well, you know... There's so many of us that still follow the sports. I couldn't find the girls' basketball game, which I was frustrated with. In fact, I had a great deal of difficulty finding when the UNB St. Mary's hockey game CIS final was on last night.
Okay.
Unfortunately, we lost 2-0, but they played extremely well. First period was a little iffy, but they came on in the second period, and Peters played their goaltender. The two goaltenders were outstanding, and they got one goal, and managed, UNB did, and sit on it, and then an empty net goal at the end of the game. So, but a silver medal in hockey and a bronze medal for the girls' basketball team. This Justine Colley is Player of the Year, and she's unbelievable.
The legacy continues.
The legacy continues,
yeah. Okay.
Well, they used to say we were a jock university, and certainly there was a lot of guys that came here, Americans who started basketball, for example, and came up to play football, but so many of them stayed around, you know. And we had marvelous, and who gave back, the Al Keiths and... people like that. Al used to, when he played football, Bob Hayes had a what he called a hustle jersey, and anybody who showed outstanding hustle would get this jersey to wear. I can remember watching Bob Hayes with that group early on. They were doing punt return drills, and they weren't doing very well, and he had no gear. And he had the original maroon color jersey with the sleeves off it, and it came to midriff. I ended up having that for quite some time, actually. But he ended up going back to receive a punt with no gear, and they were told to tackle him, and they couldn't. They couldn't get him down. He only did a couple of runs, but he was a tough man. He ended up disciplining another tough guy, Red O'Brien, Wayne O'Brien from Dartmouth. He and his brother Stu both played on the football team during the Puma era. And Wayne will be around if they have next year. They're having hopefully a recognition and honor for the, what would it be, 64 football team. And I think it's what it is. Anyway, they're Red.
The Atlantic Bowl team.
Exactly. And Red was watching a basketball game, and somehow or another he ended up with one of the opposing player's sneakers, and he wouldn't give it back to him. And this was in the old pit.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Hayes' office was up at the top of the where the canteen was, across in the stairwell where our lockers were. Mm-hmm. And even at high school we had lockers in there with the college guys.
Mm-hmm.
And he took him up, and I can remember going up. I didn't know he was even there, but all of a sudden I was going heading to the washroom, and I heard quite a commotion going on in the office. Coach Hayes came out of the office, obviously having been in an altercation, and that kind of adrenaline tremble and some bruised knuckles, and Mr. O'Brien was... indisposed, and he was one tough guy. But you wouldn't do that. Now, you know, you don't get away with that kind
of
stuff.
Of course,
nowadays, but.
But it put a lot of grit in the team.
Oh, it put a lot of grit. You know, and Red would tell you today that he was out of line.
Yeah.
So it was sort of like the corporal punishment with the Jesuits.
Yeah.
You just accepted it because that was the way things were.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. And trying to look on the bright side.
Yeah.
Of things, which was.
But
well,
we had amazing coaches, you know, from the Brian Heaney coming from Acadia, probably one of the best all-time basketball players ever to play in university sports in Canada, and then became our coach and brought us to huge levels of success. you know, and then through all the sports, we had some really good long-term coaches, you know, like Trevor is now, Steinberg with the hockey, and Ross Quackenbush for a number of years with the basketball. You know,
what is your impression today of academics at St. Mary's, sports at St. Mary's? Do you feel like the university is going in a good direction?
Well, you know, I think there's been over time sort of hills and valleys with the academics now is so amazing. I walked in the wrong side when I came in last week. I walked up to the third floor looking for the archive office, and I'm seeing astrophysics and offices that are, I'm thinking, wow, this is really something. You know, they have, I have a TESOL degree, but now they're having a whole building with, you know, teaching English second language.
Yeah,
and,
right, yeah.
You know, it's, and I think the, I take nothing away from the quality of the teaching that we receive, but it's a much broader base, you know, and there are so many more things for students to choose from now, and academics certainly has, I think, become stronger, and I think there was a period of time maybe when, I mean, we look at the condition of the football stadium, which I hear is there are going to be some changes made. Good friend Dave Murphy, who is back as athletic director.
That's right.
So pleased to see that he's I guess exemplified, you know, as a doctor to academically and had success in his career
and as a Santa Marian
yeah. No question, and certainly he's going to make a balance as best he can, and so I'm kind of looking forward to the next segment. As I say, the sports teams, we've got some new leadership in the football, and hopefully that'll bring some new recruits. And it's all about recruiting now.
Right, yeah.
You know, it really is.
Definitely. Well, I think we have a lot to offer.
Yeah, and I think the same thing is true with the student, academic student body, too. It's all about recruiting, you know, getting the foreign students now, because our population base in the Maritimes is dwindling.
Right.
So, you know, they need to, and they have, and I think, you know.
Not just the gender of students, but the culture and
international. Yes, yeah. Well, the multicultural component, you ask about changes.
Yeah.
The accessibility is one thing, and the multicultural, those are two things that stand out. They certainly weren't there when I, Jerry Lawrence, who was a prominent radio personality and politician back in the 60s, 70s. Jerry was in a wheelchair, and I can remember Jerry Lawrence wanting to go to a basketball game in the pit and having to go down, and I was quite amazed. It's why I got involved with the wheelchair basketball, going down the stairs without any support, balancing himself wheel by wheel down each step to the down into the gym. Quite amazing. Amazing.
So. Wow. Yeah. So those kind of changes.
Yeah. Oh, the changes were
happening.
Were important.
Time
yeah.
And things, but
yeah. And hopefully, as they rethink how they're going to go about the athletic program. I know there was some money. A very good hockey player, in my generation, Bobby Daphne, just prior to my generation, but I watched him play. Bobby Daphne gave one of the biggest donations to the university in his will, $1 million, and that is still somewhere, but because he specified that it was to go to a rink, to a hockey arena, and so we'll see now that they have, whether they stay at the Forum. I rather like going to the Forum, because I'm old enough to remember when fights used to take place up there and wrestling.
Right, yeah.
And, but
Grand Prix,
Grand Prix wrestling, so.
But we may have the campus is always expanding and changing.
Yes, yeah.
The student body is changing, but hopefully the spirit of the institution remains.
No, yeah, I think it does. You know, from I'm here. I come down for the different sporting events and that kind of thing. And although I had some, you know, trying to find my way through the different buildings is a bit of a challenge now. I mean, we came from a one building, and then they had the library, and which then became language school. And, so it's amazing how big the campus has gotten. So.
Well, is there anything else you think you might like to add or touch upon?
No, I'll probably think of lots when I heading home.
Well, we can always follow up. You know, it was very fascinating hearing these stories, and of course, I really appreciate it too. You know, because I love St. Mary's.
Yes,
I love going here as well. I like to paint my face up for the games.
Yeah,
we go.
Good for you.
Yeah. So thank you very much on behalf of
thank
the
you.
Archive.
Appreciate
Patrick
it.
Parham Library.
I should quickly mention Knucker Burns, talking about people who were cheerleaders.
Yeah.
And Knucker Burns was a fabulous cheerleader of St. Mary's team. And another guy whose name was Jonesy. He sort of took over from Knucker. Knucker was back in the 50s.
Okay. Oh, and, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Foam, the Foam Finger Brigade.
Yeah. Well, he was his own cheerleader, and he was amazing.
Okay.
And everybody knew him. But yeah, we'll continue to cheer
Perfect.
On the teams.
Yeah,
and thank you so
definitely.
Much.
Thank
appreciate
you
it.
Again. I really appreciate it.